welcome, Red Ice members. Thank you very much for tuning in here to our second segment with Jim Elwich, author of The Universe Sold. We are continuing our very interesting conversation about the singularity, about the, I guess you can say, the stress-related issues that comes along with all the technological interruptions that we've begun to encounter here in the last couple of years. And this is really interesting. Jim, we were just talking about here in the last segment here about basically the quality of the work. I guess that is something that gradually kind of is diminishing with the fact that we're becoming more and more, shattered in our, even in our thinking process. We're not either, focusing enough on one thing at a time because we're all over the place. And as you described to me, Jim, this meeting basically where you have 12 people that are sitting around, but everyone is everywhere else. They're texting on their cell phone, they're answering emails or what have you. And as you mentioned, this is really interesting because that then might actually lead to the gradual slowing down of the progress, if you will, of where we're going with all of this. This might potentially mean that people are so shattered in their thinking process that they can't even focus on one thing at a time. And that would automatically mean that we will not come to this, cusp point of the singularity, or people will work less and less. Do you think that this is a construct, maybe then, of the program itself? That overflood them with the information in that sense, and that will generate that this process of advancement would slowly ease down. What do you think, Jim?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's a very real possibility, and I it reminds me of. If you've ever played any of the Sim games, especially thinking Sim City might be the one where you develop a city, and basically they have some rules in there with sort of feedback mechanisms built in. If you put too much entertainment in your city, then people aren't doing creative work. Or if you create a city that has too much industrial pollution, it won't evolve well. And you have to have a nice balance of cultural enrichment and job opportunities and parks and different areas and things like that.
Yes.
To develop a healthy city. And if you think of our reality or our world, if it is under program control, it's a much, much more complex version of that. So
yes.
Programmers, if you will, have probably already realized about limitations of human potential or of our mental capacity. And so these feedback mechanisms are built in to prevent things like singularities from occurring.
Mm.
So, I completely agree that that's a very likely scenario. And I do see in industry how people work a lot less effectively than they could or than they used to.
Yeah.
There's a Zen concept that music is the space between the notes.
Yes.
You have to have some time to think, and if you don't have time to think, you're not going to come up with the new, the creative ideas and the innovations that really help drive progress.
I wonder if this is where the Western world's approach to all of this kind of goes bust, if you know what I mean, and the new innovation might come from somewhere else. I'm thinking about new creative people in India or even China, and over there, obviously a lot of under stress there as well, of course, as we talked in the break here, a lot of the production, if you will, of the things that we use in the West now are done over there. But yet again, what I'm getting at is that the new ideas, the innovation, might come from somewhere else, and we might be subject to them in the next couple of years. That the power shifts, if you know what I mean. What do you think, Jim?
Oh yeah, I think that's definitely a real possibility. A shift, and it's very easy for us, sort of in the U.S. and Europe to, view a shift when we see jobs being outsourced to Asian countries and to civilizations where they pay lower rates and things like that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they're struggling as well, and a lot of those economies, Brazil, for example, and Eastern Europe, China, they're built on being, basically being exporters and being
exactly.
Exporters to the Western.
Yes.
So when we have a period like we have now, where we're in a bit of a recession, people are spending less, people are buying less, those economies suffer as well, especially if they're not designed to be self-sustaining and they're just, you know, basically built around the idea of exporting to the Western. So if that's the case, then they just have to work harder too, and they're probably subject to the same kind of stresses and inabilities to, you know, think clearly as we are if they're getting squeezed to generate more product faster and cheaper.
That's absolutely true. It's definitely, it is a global system, whether we want it or not by now, actually. How about, you know, things like biological computers, quantum computers? There is talk, there is developments, there is research going on, something that potentially might totally revolutionize the way that we compute information. There seems to be a lot of problems, though, as always, that they're encountering and things they never thought about. You know, we've heard about these new technologies for quite some time, but, and I should say I haven't followed it every single step of the research and the developments, but do you see any of those new technologies becoming available or coming online, as they say, at all? Or do you think that those also is subject to the same rules, if you will, that we just talked about?
Yeah, and both, actually. I mean, I think that Moore's Law has a history of reaching, or technologies that follow Moore's Law, they reach certain plateaus at certain points, and then a new technology will take over. And what you're really talking about is sort of like the underlying, the underlying item that you're measuring might be something like, you know, computational cycles per second, or ability to have a high resolution screen or something like that. The underlying technologies can change. So where, you know, we used to have bipolar transistors, and then we went to field effect transistors, and we had completely different sort of technology paradigm shifts. Moore's Law just marched ahead, and I think that's what you're talking about with biological computers. We're probably going to reach the limit of the silicon-based constructs at some point due to heat or whatever, and there will have to be something that takes over, and voila, there usually is, because people at research labs are researching the biological computers or nanotech-based paradigms, quantum computing, things like that. So they take over then, and they present a whole different set of problems and solutions. Quantum computing is good for certain things, and it's bad for other things, just like the human brain is, really good at assimilating information, but really bad at being, exact at calculations in a very fast period of time.
So
I see the shifts in technology occurring. They will allow us to kind of leapfrog a little bit, but they're also going to be plagued by their own specific set of issues, like we see today.
Yeah, because really, from what I've heard from Aubrey de Grey or Ray Kurzweil again, or Anders Söderberg or Nick Bostrom, as you mentioned before, it's really it seems very kind of undefinable as well. I mean, okay, I understand it, because the technological singularity really is about something that happens in that sense, and after that point, we really don't know where it's going to go. So it is difficult to kind of perceive of it, of course, but it seems also difficult to even explain how we're supposed to end up there. It's more like, well, we create AI, and then something just happens, and then we are, here we go. But I think it will take much more creativity, if you will, from our part, or work from our part, in order to understand it. And what I'm seeing potentially is more and more as we talk here today, and things I've been thinking about myself, is that things are often much more complex than we think they are, and we will probably encounter problems along the way, which will tell us a whole lot, not only about ourselves, actually, when we try to create an intelligent life, and that will hint at what we are, of course. But these problems along the line, that probably will upset quite a few things and problems along the way. And I don't, it's very difficult. I don't see that that's something that's going to, just happen tomorrow in that sense, and we're relying too much on just looking at the future. Do you think that there's something kind of tangible that they need to do or to overcome at this particular point in order to progress forward faster? Is there a particular problem right now that you see that we're facing?
Yes, to quote Yoda from Star Wars, always foggy is the future.
Right.
I think that it's really hard to say what kind of things are going to get in the way of progress, but I think that one thing that you can predict is that there will be things that get in the way of progress. So I just think you can take almost any technology. Just think about computer viruses. That was something that probably wasn't predicted much long before the computer viruses, that there would be this kind of technology that would prevent or slow down the ability to do useful work. So that was something that it generated an entire industry of antivirus programs and hackers that tried to defeat those, and that came out of the blue. If it weren't for that, people might be able to create faster, more efficient, less bloated operating systems. Operating systems are full of patches and things like that, security patches to prevent these kinds of hacks and so forth. Imagine if that energy were to go into pure productivity aspects of the operating system or of the software instead of security types of features.
Yes.
So those kinds of things are going to happen, and with nanotech, there's been always the specter of gray goo, and with artificial intelligence, there's a specter of bad AI that kind of take over, and we have to we have to defeat those things. In order to really make progress, we have to either prevent them or defeat them as they occur.
Yeah, absolutely.
That takes energy, and that slows down the speed of productivity and the speed of the evolution toward a singularity.
Absolutely. And in regards to, let's take security or hacking or something like that, one idea that popped up here in the first segment as we talked was this idea about if we are living in a programmed reality and this is being run, let's say, by a computer, that this is real, really a program, so to speak, of a mainframe somewhere running this. Do you think it would be possible to hack reality, to find a way into to beat some of the laws that is incorporated within the system?
Well, they did it in the Matrix, right?
Exactly. right.
That's an interesting one. To hack something, you have to be smarter than whatever it was that created it, and so that sort of goes to human nature. The idea of hacking, the idea of defeating something is, it's kind of the malicious intent that might be part of human nature. Is it part of, Dvizigin nature or whatever the entity might be that has created the program? If you think in that terms, maybe it's not. So maybe there aren't hacker dangers, or we would have seen them by now. Or maybe, as has been suggested to me in the past, that things like UFO sightings or, sort of the metaphysical anomalies that show up in our reality periodically could be due to hackers just, getting in and injecting crazy little things that people see and only some people see. And
yes.
Maybe it's being hacked.
That's really interesting. And exactly. I think they have this deja vu scene in the Matrix where when they patch something or change something in the code, it happens twice, and people are perceptive enough can kind of pick up on this and see that something is weird or offbeat, as it were. The question here also regarding, if we talk about reality, something that we kind of left off on in the first segment as we were going into more about this idea that singularity not will happen. Before that, we were talking about how it is possible then that reality isn't, or does not happen, rather, I should say, until it is observed. It doesn't become manifest until we have an awareness in there that can perceive something. the question then comes to a little bit of, to the brain, I guess, of the function of the brain. I've talked about with some other people about this on the show as well, and it would be interesting to get your take on this, Jim. And that is the fact of what the role of the brain might be here. If the brain actually is a kind of a decoder, if you will, of this program, either code running or even the quantum level of things, that the brain is basically an electrical circuit or unit that is decoding reality, and then we think that we are perceiving reality, you know, through our brain. What's your take on all that, Jim? Do you have an idea?
Yeah, sure. Interesting question, and I'll put forth a hypothesis here. And if you think about as another analogy, let's go back to say your favorite online video game, and let's imagine that there's a room that nobody's been in. Maybe there's even a door to the room, and all the characters have gone up to the room, and they've tried to get in, they knock on the door, they push on the door, they try all of the tools at their disposal to figure out how to get into this room, and they've been unable to do it up to a certain point. So there doesn't need to be anything inside the room. The room doesn't have to be designed, there don't have to be artifacts. You know, from the programmer's standpoint, it can just be this mysterious room that they don't have to create, they don't have to populate with anything, until somebody finds a key to get into the room. And as soon as they do that, as soon as they figure out how to open the door to the room, then there has to be something there. And there always is something there, which, and the reason there's something there is because the key was placed for someone to find by the programmers. Or because the people who are playing the game have figured out a way to hack and get into the room.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you take the same analogy and think about our reality the same way, here's one hypothesis. All of our intent is being received and recorded. So we have a reality construct. Everything that we see and everything that we can experience is basically generated by this program. But in addition, the program is able to read the intent of all of the conscious entities, all these sentient entities that are interacting with the program, and make it a decision on the next state of the program based on that intent. So one individual might not have significant influence over the course of the reality or the course of events that occur in the reality, but they might have some influence because all of the intents of all of the sentient beings are being collected and assimilated. And in that way, it explains a lot. It explains why quantum effects show that reality isn't true until you observe it, because the fact of observation is the reading of the intent, and therefore then, as a result of that intent, the effect is is changing the reality, or,
yes,
or making the waveform collapse, if you will, in quantum mechanical terms. And yet, it's also possible that a single person's intent could be chosen to cause something to happen. So you may have these aberrations or these abnormal anomalies where, you know, a large scale, a macroscopic thing seems to occur due to your intent, and people report that all the time. I've heard cases of people who have known that an accident was coming and swerved and had no idea why they swerved, because the oncoming car was not even in their field of view. They couldn't have peripherally seen it or sensed it or anything like that.
Huh.
But they were given the notion to to take evasive maneuvers and thus avoid an accident. This would explain those kinds of effects, and it would also explain why things like the Princeton pair experiments show that when global consciousness lines up and sort of becomes coherent, when everybody thinks the same thing at the same time, events seem to occur. You're probably familiar with that, where they have these eggs that have been running basically computational devices, random number generators,
yes,
60 or 70 of them throughout the world, and they've noticed that they tend to be non-random. They tend to line up when everybody's
right.
or those kinds of events. But more interesting is the fact that the aberration in the randomness of the numbers occurs before the event actually occurs.
Yes, yes. Huh.
You know, why is that? And so that may be an indication that there is some, you know, pre-knowledge of what's going on by the program, that there is some collection of intent of the individuals. You know, there have been cases of, you know, people doing collective intent to try to make it rain. I don't know that anybody's ever done a study to show whether that is statistically significant or not, but I've heard a lot of anecdotal cases where, you know, thousands and thousands of people, perhaps, you know, tens of thousands of people have concentrated on making it rain in a drought-ridden area, and within 24 hours of doing so, they get an unexpected storm that the meteorologist can't figure out.
Yes.
So this could be that effect. It could be the effect of your program receiving the intent of all the people and having the logic to say, okay, when this intent lines up, this is a reasonable thing, you know, to do for the next step of the program.
But would you think also that suggests a little bit that things are, that we're also living in a pre-programmed reality, that things are set out from the start to follow a certain line of events or happenings, as it were, that things that are happening in our world really aren't spontaneous and so forth, but this is that we're on a really pre-programmed path here, so to speak.
If that were true, you'd have to accept that you have no free will, right?
Yes.
And that, you know, I have a hard time with that concept. I used to be a believer that people didn't have free will because I viewed the brain in a reductionist way. I felt that the mind was in the brain and the brain was basically responding purely to sensory stimuli and, you know, basically the physical state of the brain plus all the stimuli coming in is what caused the next thought and caused the next, you know, intent to occur.
Yeah.
However, there's been a lot of recent studies that the brain or that the mind is not necessarily in the brain, that the mind, in fact, there was an article in the New Scientist recently about that the mind is somewhere extraneous to the brain. The brain is more of a cache, if you will, of memories and processing power.
Yeah.
And that the real intent, thought process, free will may be occurring from somewhere else. So, yeah, I suppose it's possible, but if that were the case, then it would be, I think it's kind of a depressing scenario to say that everything is predestined and that we have no ability to control or influence it.
I mean, when you're tossing around like ideas like these around, when you're, you know, juggling with these different ideas about programming, some other kind of potential sentient being or entities involved here, have you spent a lot of time thinking about the actual programmers, you know, or programmer? And if so, what's your thought on them or it?
No, I would just have to say that if being the operative word, if we are in such a scenario, I would have to believe that the programmers are so much more advanced than us than, you know, say 50 years time frame, and therefore unable for us to comprehend their thought process. Perhaps they're even not human.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, there's no way we can understand the thought process.
Mm.
We think we can understand the thought process of, you know, of animals, a cat or a dog, and we're constantly being surprised at, you know, how they behave. And, you know, different experiments are constantly showing that animals behave in different ways than we previously thought.
Yes.
We can't even understand less complicated sentient beings in ourselves, let alone ones that are so far advanced to be able to create such a programmed reality.
Mm. Yeah, that's really interesting. Why don't we spend a little time, because I don't think that we did this last time you were on the show, Jim, talking about the power of 10. This is something that you've been writing about on your website. Maybe you can give us a little bit of background or an outline of this concept of the power of 10.
Oh, sure. The power say originally, I think it came out in the 70s or 80s. It was a film that showed, basically the idea was to show 10 times magnification every, you know, unit of time, so every second or every few seconds. So let's say you start out looking at a rose bush or something, and then you move, you're a meter away from the rose bush, and then you move 10 meters away, and now you see, you know, the rose bush and its surrounding areas, and then you're 100 meters away, and then 1,000 meters away. And so it's sort of an exponentially changing perspective. I mean, it's a way to show the scale of things in a, you know, in a way that's understandable. People have a hard time understanding large numbers. Actually, numbers over, say, 10,000 is very difficult for people to comprehend. You know, they know what it means to have $10,000 only because they know what it means, you know, to buy something with $10,000.
Right.
To see 10,000 items versus 2,000 items is very difficult. It's very difficult to look at it and say, oh, that looks like 10,000 or that looks like 100,000.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, concepts of distance and the huge concepts of universal scales are really hard to grasp. So this idea of the powers of 10 was something that, I don't remember who originally did it, it was a way to explore that and to show people the vastness of the universe and what the universe looked like at different scales. When you go far out, you're seeing the intergalactic scale where all you see is galaxies. When you go deeper and deeper in, you start to probe cells and then molecules and ultimately atoms. So this concept has been, you know, applied to, you know, a number of different, video production companies have put these together. There have been websites that put them together. There are books that show powers of 10. And it's always very interesting to see. And you can go to, I think CERN has a powers of 10 application on their website. And you can just Google powers of 10, you'll find all kinds of them. I happen to be very proud of the one that I put up on the Universe Solved website because I really think it's better than any of the others out there for a number of reasons. First of all, I have to thank the people at CERN for letting me use a lot of their imagery.
Mm-hmm.
And some other imagery came from NASA and some was public domain and some were pictures that I took and things like that. But basically what it does is it explores more levels than anything else. So, one of the cosmological speculations is what happens when you get beyond the boundaries of our universe? Are there other universes out there that we theoretically can't see due to the limitations of the speed of light? This is the so-called Hubble volume of cosmology. You can only see as far as light has traveled over some period of time. But people suspect, or people speculate, people like Max Tegmark and other mathematicians and philosophers speculate that, hey, there could be, bubble universes out there just like ours, separated by distances that we can't perceive. Some of those may harbor life, some may not. In fact, this may explain why we appear to be in a universe that is so perfectly fine-tuned for life. Is because there are so many others that aren't, and just through laws of probability, you know, there's going to be one every once in a while that's perfectly fine-tuned as we are. That's known as the anthropic principle.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I'm digressing a little bit, but I just
it's fine.
You know, explain some of the concepts of the powers of 10. So my powers of 10 doesn't end at intergalactic space. It goes out into the metaverse, into the multiverse, where there may be multiple universes, and it shows, you know, sort of philosophical, cosmological speculations of what it might really be if you could see that far, if you weren't encumbered by the speed of light. And at the same time, going in the other direction, it probes into quantum mechanics. So it goes past what we know about the atom, what we speculate about the constituents of the atom, what string theorists speculate about it, and I just use string theory because it's the, you know, favorite theory right now of what explains all the subatomic particles. They're just different vibrating because those are the ultimate constituents of matter. And my view is that that's just today's point of view, and even if we show string theory to proven to be true, then at some point somebody's going to say, hey, well, what are those strings made of? And, you know, maybe we'll be able to have a fast enough accelerator that can probe the depths of string theory.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go a little further and, you know, keep on peering deeper and deeper past string theory, and let's take a look at what it looks like down at the quantum level at the Planck length. And, you know, so basically with all of today's speculation in mind, both at the quantum level and at the cosmological level, I try to put that all into one big powers of 10 simulation application that you can run on the website. In addition to that, I allow places where you can jump into a parallel reality, which is another concept that you've explored on your show, that a lot of people have talked about, that there could be parallel worlds out there.
Yes.
It's a quantum mechanical idea, it's a cosmological idea also, and it's a interdimensional idea. So there's three different ways that that people have come at this angle, but, you know, let's imagine that it's true and that there is a way to jump to another reality. I allow reality jumps between different powers of 10 simulations. One of them jumps to a programmed reality, which is very similar to the sort of traditional view of physics and cosmology, except when it gets down to the deep levels, it's going to show that everything's just created from information. And maybe when it gets further out, it doesn't need to go as far out because we can't, you know, we can't perceive anything further out anyway.
Hmm.
And then I jump to another sort of more fun and speculative approach that has a couple surprises in it. So in my opinion, the powers of 10 that's on the universe solved is a real fun one to explore, and I encourage any of your listeners to do that. And you know, feel free to write me with suggestions and pass along the link to your friends.
Absolutely, no, it's great fun to follow up on some of that. I don't want to give anything away. I should just say that people should definitely check out that and jump forward and backward in some of these the parallel realities, as it were. But I mean, what do you think about, again, if we talk about maybe things like fringe science? I mean, there was recently an idea about teleportation, for instance. There was a news story on New Scientist, I think it was, that allegedly came a little bit closer now to some kind of teleportation. They did an experiment that were able to send basically a string of numbers, whatever, of some kind of small information bit, as it were, about a yard or something like that. But that still kind of, I guess, is incorporated into the whole quantum physics, quantum mechanics type of idea, that this isn't really fringe science. We just need to learn to harness the quantum world, or understand the quantum world better in order to utilize it. Because as you said previously, Jim, you talk about this idea that you know, locality is something that isn't what we perceived, or possibly what we perceived it to be, meaning that we can't possibly invent teleportation machines, or we can invent something that has to do with, I don't know if we want to go so far as time travel, of course, that's a little bit of a different thing, but things like teleportation, if we take that, do you think that that's something that is possible within the framework of what we can see reality is right now?
Yeah, I think absolutely. And teleportation is a great example, because we are pushing the limits of it. It was something, you know, with the Star Trek teleporter was always purely in the realm of science fiction, until quantum physicists started teleporting particles under the Danube River. And, you know, to be a little more precise, what they're teleporting is information about the particle. So they're not really sending a particle.
Okay.
They're sending information about the particle. But then if you think, well, what is a particle but information anyway, then maybe they really are sending that particle. So when you talk about macroscopic devices or macroscopic objects, this is something that's going to follow Moore's law again. So the ability to teleport the information about an atom is, you know, was yesterday's limitations of teleportation. Today's it's molecules, and tomorrow it's going to be, you know, macroscopic devices. You know, something created from a large number of molecules, a you know, billionth of a gram of material, and then you know, some time after that it'll be a millionth of a gram, and then pretty soon it will be a mouse or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So then the question becomes, what are you really teleporting? One of the things that has been, you know, a big question in science fiction is, when we get to the point where we can teleport things, will we be able to teleport our, our bodies? Yes, if you believe that you can recreate at the, you know, distant receiver of the teleportation, you can completely recreate your body. That seems to be something that is certainly possible, because all the information that's needed to reconstruct your body can be sent through this teleportation channel. So if that happens and you reconstruct your body, where does your mind go? Does your mind stay in the original place, or does it move over to the new place?
Right.
For people who believe that that we have a soul, or we have a spirit that is not embedded in our brain, they would tend to believe that, hey, that new body that just got created by the molecular compiler and the other, you know, the other end of the teleportation device, that's a robot. You know, that that is not me. I'm never going to pass through that channel.
Hmm.
However, if you think about this from the programmed reality standpoint, we are in control of the body that we're in. And perhaps we decide, hey, I'm going to jump from the source teleportation port to the destination teleportation port, and I will allow my consciousness to go from one body to the other.
Mm.
If that can be done, and you know, my prediction is, if we are in a programmed reality, that is theoretically possible. It wouldn't be theoretically possible if we're not in a programmed reality, and you know, and we have a soul. But again, it would be possible if we're not in a programmed reality and we have no soul, and all we are is a construct of you know, of the complexity of our brain. So it's a really interesting thing to think about, and my view is that we will be able to teleport at some point, and we will be able to move our consciousness from one entity to another.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the reason I think that this is true is that I just feel, from the standpoint of, you know, trying to understand what life is all about. You know, what is it?
Yes.
What does it mean for something to be alive? I think it's very curious that people die and can't be resuscitated. Why is that? Why would it be, if, you know, if all that's making our bodily processes go is a, you know, flow of blood and a beating heart and, you know, and all of that, why can't that be reversed at some point, say within 15 minutes of dying? You know, an artificial heart or a stimulation of a heart just generates the blood flow, and boom, the person's back to life.
Mm.
Well, you know, the answer to that has traditionally been, your brain cells have died, so it's impossible for you to sustain that. But that doesn't mean that, you know, that you couldn't reinfuse life into somebody with damaged brain cells. And it also flies in the face of some recent research that shows that brain cells do survive much, much longer than the time frame that is typically thought to be the time frame beyond which you can't resuscitate somebody.
Mm-hmm.
So taking all this into account, there's a very curious aspect of life, which seems to be that when it's over, independent of whether or not the body can sustain life thereafter,
mm-hmm.
which tells me that there's something else beyond you know, the soul and the machine. There's something else out there. Part of the reason why I believe that, you know, I believe in the soul. I believe that there's a, you know, we are effectively avatars, you know, driven by our consciousness, that our consciousness is probably elsewhere. And
That's interesting. It's because there is this idea that basically the as you said before, that the mind is something that is external to the brain, and this idea that if the brain were to be, you know, together with the whole body, of course, teleported to somewhere else, that the, you know, the brain generates basically a electromagnetic field, if you will, and it's this field that's kind of is the connecting force, I don't know what to call it, to your mind or to your soul, even in that sense, meaning that wherever in the in space that this particular electromagnetic field occurs or happens to be, that's where the soul will be connected to, meaning the same idea again, that we have this idea of non-locality. It doesn't matter where it ends up being, because it really isn't about distance in that sense. We're in this space and we can move wherever we want to move, basically, and we will be whole wherever we pop up, or I don't know if that makes sense to you or not, but it seems to resonate with me, at least in the idea of the holographic universe again, that space and time, yeah, in that sense doesn't really matter. You know what I mean?
Exactly. And you know, I completely agree with that point of view, and I think that there's a lot of anecdotal evidence to support that point of view in things like out-of-body experiences or near-death experiences. You know, the problem with these things is that they don't follow the scientific method. It's impossible to have a reproducible study of out-of-body experiences or near-death experiences. So all that can be done is a collection of anecdotes, anecdotal evidence, and things like that. However, people have done some, you know, scientific studies of things like out-of-body experiences, and you can find those in The Holographic Universe, Michael Talbot's book.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting. So, you know, it's basically based on sort of psychological or experimental constructs. Take a number of people who have had them, ask them questions, ask their doctors questions, and, you know, come to conclusions based on their results, and rule out all of the, you know, sort of the noise or the extraneous circumstances that could explain them. And what you're left with is that OBEs occur.
Yes.
And near-death experiences are not explained by processes in the brain. And, you know, as many people that are out there, skeptics who say, that's fiction, I would just suggest that they have an open mind and look at things like, you know, the past history of scientific short-sightedness. In mm-hmm. the 1800s, the professor of physiology in Toulouse, Pierre Pachet, said that Louis Pasteur's theory of germs was ridiculous fiction.
Right.
You know, Albert Einstein in 1932 said there's not the slightest indication that nuclear energy will ever be obtainable. And in the 1800s, rocks falling from the sky, a.k.a. meteors, were viewed by scientists the same way that UFOs are viewed today. So these things that seem to be impossible, that seem to fly in the face of the scientific status quo, are just, you know, a lot of them are things that are just going to be broken at some point in the future. And the key thing is to have an open mind about it.
Well, exactly. And that's also why I kind of am so interested in many of the new scientific discoveries, because in many cases they kind of deconstruct what we thought previously about reality, basically, and even about the human being or consciousness that we have been talking about here now. And it seems to me that in any case, whatever, you know, viewpoint we have in it, in our baggage, so to speak, if it's, you know, religious or only scientific or what have you, it's tends to show a very interesting picture that either, you know, leads us up to the point of what we talk about here today, a program reality, or that there's some kind of weirdness going on, in the sense that things are not at all what we perceive them to be. Many people, I guess, will put in the idea of God there, those who come from a religious background or what have you. But in any case, what it says to me is that we're learning a heck of a lot of who we are, where we're going, and where, you know, of where we might end up if we continue with this, with the development of the science. And I just hope personally that the close-mindedness of things is something that slowly will kind of disintegrate, if you will, that people will discover. I at least have discovered, you know, wonderful things about what the human being is and what life is about just by observing the new scientific discoveries. And hopefully this is something that will continue this trend, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's there's a big difference between the way Western education treats some of these things and Eastern education treats some of these things.
Yes.
Ideas like energy centered of the body are well understood and respected in Eastern cultures and not so much in Western cultures. And both parties can't be right. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, you know, I think having an open mind about a lot of these things is really important. And it's real easy to do one of two things. Either accept what has been proven as the only group or category of things that really exist, or just do some hand waving and say, "Oh, it must be a god that that's in control of all of this." You know, and those are sort of two extremes of how people deal with these kinds of questions. I'm a little bit more in the middle, where I say, you know, I'm going to just be extremely open-minded, and I can imagine, you know, there's not an anomaly that I have ever heard that I can't imagine an answer for. So if I can imagine an answer for it that even follows sort of the rules that I know about computation, about, you know, our reality, then it's possible.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's it gives us another perspective on life, even the basic outlook of it, or on life. I think that if we incorporate the idea of a program reality, that will the general idea that things are, you know, the seriousness of it all doesn't mean that things become, just a joke or whatever. That's not what I'm saying, but I'm saying that the seriousness of life can be perceived somewhat differently if we think about it, that we're in a computer game, basically, in that sense. Might be very scary to some, obviously, in that way too, but I feel that this is something that might be necessary for many people at this point to step back for a little while and question what the whole thing is, just that, because to skip some of the narrow-mindedness that many people are, you know, kind of suffering from today in that sense. And hopefully this is a view that will help to contribute to that, open people up, basically, you know?
Yeah, thank you. I agree. I agree 100%.
Okay, Jim, why don't we begin here to round things off for this time. Again, the book is The Universe Solved, and it's a really, really, really interesting hypothesis and idea, and I know that you bring up a lot of different theories and evidence to suggest that this is the case, that we're living in a programmed reality, of course. Why don't you go ahead and mention your website again for us, so people can go there, and also how we would go about getting a copy of your book.
Sure, thank you. The website is called theuniversesolved.com. The Universe Solved, exactly the way it sounds, and I'm sure it'll be linked up there on Red Ice Creations as well. The book can be purchased directly on the website if you live in the United States. It can be purchased through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, if you live elsewhere, and it's in the ISBN database, so bookstores who don't carry on the shelves can order it, and we have shipped books out that way as well. The website, even if you're not interested in the book, I'm not here to push the book. I'm really more interested in people getting involved in the site and sharing ideas and exploring the ideas that are on the site. So to that extent, I've tried to build the site to be very interactive. We have polls on the site, so you can take polls where you can put in your thoughts about time travel or extraterrestrial life or whatever. There are articles on there about, you know, the ideas that we've talked about tonight. There are also links to other sites that explore the same ideas. I have a blog, but probably one of the most interesting parts of the site is the forum. So there's a section there where people can just join up and, you know, explore, you know, whatever ideas they want. We have categories stories on philosophy and transhumanism and singularities, anomalies, scientific and technology categories on AI, cosmology, nanotech, quantum mechanics, robotics, gaming, and it's open to just sort of general queries as well. So there's a lot of information there. There are news links for a lot of these areas, and a lot of interactivity. And we mentioned the powers of 10. And the other thing I'd like to mention too is there's what's called a chat bot, or basically an artificial intelligence on there named Morpheus, and you can log in and talk to him and share your thoughts about him through some polls, and you can write to me and tell me what you think as well. So a lot to explore on the website, and we're adding to it all the time.
Brilliant. TheUniverseSolved.com. Go there, check it out. A lot of information up there for you. Jim, thank you very much again for coming on. It's been really interesting, as always, and we hope to have you back again, and keep up the great work, okay?
Thank you very much, Henrik. It was a pleasure, and keep up the good work on your site, too. I love your site as well.
Thank you very much. That's our program with Jim Elovidge. We'll talk more on Thursday with you and Lynn Marsouli about his new book, The Alien Interviews. In the meantime, take good care, and we'll see you online.